A duck blind on Real Foot Lake in northwestern Tennessee becomes the unlikely site of a double homicide. Then the suspect's body is discovered floating in the murky waters nearby to the scene of the crime. Murder, murder,
Maya Miliete goes missing from Chula Vista after a fight with her husband, leading friends and family to believe he might be involved.
Tune in to Murder, Murder News, the Listen Edition, every Friday for the biggest true crime cases making headlines each week.
Subscribe to Murder, Murder News, the Listen Edition, wherever you listen to podcasts. Murder, Murder News.
Hello and welcome to Reverie True Crime. I'm your host, Paige.
They've got the whole world in their hands. They've got her whole wide world in her hands. They've got her whole wide world in their hands. They've got her whole world in their hands.
Life is multifaceted. Each day, each relationship, each interaction builds you to who you are and who you will be. You are the sum of your days. You are one of the most complicated summations that could ever be drafted, formulated, and proofed. Much like your life has come to this very moment, the moment you are listening to this episode, Eileen's life has come to a moment of judgment by a group of human beings. I think one of the most important lessons to be learned is that anything created by humans is flawed, as most humans themselves are flawed. To believe ourselves or the systems we create to be perfect would be folly. Improvement is always an option. Bettering oneself is always an option. Imagine looking at Earth from orbit, over 200 miles above the surface of the Earth. You know that there are a multitude of species, lives, histories, and futures. You know that Earth consists of an unending amount of life, conflict, peace, war, hate, love, and more. You know that the Earth is indeed a sum of its millions upon billions upon trillions of parts. But one of the best parts of looking at the Earth from 200 miles above is that the Earth presents itself as one large entity. You are able to take in the entirety of the planet without having to deal with the individual situations, conflicts, and more. The peace that comes with taking in an entire image consisting of all parts while not having to experience those parts is almost stress-relieving, and one of the prime contributors to astronauts always mentioning what they notice first in space. Sultan bin Salman al-Saud said, "The first day or so, we all pointed to our countries. The third day, we were pointing to our continents. By the fifth day, we were only aware of Earth." Yuri Gagarin says, "I saw for the first time the Earth's shape. I could easily see the shores of continents, islands, great rivers, folds of the terrain, large bodies of water. The horizon is dark blue, smoothly turning to black. The feelings which filled me I can express with one word, joy." From space, all you can get are broad strokes of Earth. While Earth, from the ground, can be ugly, it can also be beautiful. While Earth can be overwhelming without being on the ground, you miss the specifics of what makes Earth, well, Earth. Allow me to zoom in on Earth. Let's approach the North American continent, and now to the United States. to Florida, Volusia County, the courthouse. As we approach the face of the defendant, Eileen Warnos, she is sitting, listening to the final considerations being given to the jury. As she sits there, she becomes a planet. She becomes someone the jury is making a life or death decision about, with only one of the broadest strokes painted about her: her life, relationships, history, future, and more. And just like the Earth being viewed from above, she is being viewed from the perspective of a winged bird, looking down upon her timeline with nary a consideration about specifics. The jury, indeed, has her whole world in their hands. Let's get started. First, let's revisit some key points in the trial. Eileen's girlfriend, Tyra Moore, was able to get her to confess, and in exchange, she received immunity. Usually, during a criminal trial, anything you've done prior to what you are being charged for is not allowed to be presented in court. However, under Florida's William Rule, which states evidence of collateral crimes are admissible if it assists in showing a motive, knowledge, intention, modus operandi, or lack of mistake. Therefore, the prosecution made sure to show and say certain things about the other six murders that would possibly help their case against Eileen. Tyra also took the stand and would not look Eileen in the face as she testified that Eileen did tell her she had killed a man the day Richard Mallory was murdered. Of course, Tyra was never charged of anything since she was under the protection of immunity. Eileen took the stand in her own defense, and the cross-examination was ruthless. Some think since the prosecution knew about her mental illnesses, they purposely ran her in circles and confused her. Others, however, think there was no issue with the cross-examination at all, and all the right things were done by the state. This is a complicated case, with people either taking the side of the state, believing Eileen is a cold-blooded killer, with other people being too torn between Eileen's mental illnesses, her life, and her possible state of mind due to all of the trauma she endured throughout her life, and quite possibly during the alleged torture and rape by Richard Mallory, to make a decision either way. During the penalty phase of the trial, psychologist Elizabeth McMahon testified that she met with Eileen on 5 or 6 different occasions for approximately 22 hours altogether. She performed neuropsychological and personality testing. Eileen was also not aware that Ms. McMahon had studied her police reports, investigation reports, past psychological and psychiatric evaluations, and school records. Eileen went over her whole life story with Ms. McMahon. During these visits, Eileen had trouble remembering and experienced confusion. Along with the neuropsychological and personality testing, it was standard protocol for Ms. McMahon to assess intellectual functioning and memory to rule in or out anything a defendant says they can or cannot remember. This helps determine whether a defendant is competent to stand trial. It has to be clear whether or not the person can remember well enough to at least cooperate with their attorney. Ms. McMahon said there was no question after Eileen explained her life history that she would perform all tests. Ms. McMahon explained that neuropsychological testing deals with the impairment of the brain and the cortex. If there is impairment of the cortical functioning, it's most likely in the cortex and at times can be subcortical. After all of these tests, Ms. McMahon concluded that Eileen suffered from borderline personality disorder. She also said she had a mild degree of cortical dysfunction, that she dealt with chronic static, splitting, and early abandonment, which I discussed in earlier episodes. Just to give a brief rundown of these illnesses and their symptoms, from MayoClinic.org, borderline personality disorder is a mental health disorder that impacts the way you think and feel about yourself and others, causing problems functioning in everyday life. It includes self-image issues, difficulty managing emotions and behavior, and a pattern of unstable relationships. With borderline personality disorder, you have an intense fear of abandonment or instability, and you may have difficulty tolerating being alone. Yet, inappropriate anger, impulsiveness, and frequent mood swings may push others away, even though you want to have a loving and lasting relationship with people. Borderline personality disorder usually begins by early adulthood. The condition seems to be worse in young adulthood and may gradually get better with age. Signs and symptoms of borderline personality disorder may include an intense fear of abandonment, even going to extreme measures to avoid real or imagined separation or rejection. A pattern of unstable, intense relationships, such as idealizing someone one moment and then suddenly believing the person doesn't care enough or is cruel. Rapid changes in self-identity and self-image that include shifting goals and values and seeing yourself as bad or as if you don't exist at all. Periods of stress-related paranoia and loss of contact with reality, lasting from a few minutes to a few hours. Impulsive and risky behavior, such as gambling, reckless driving, unsafe sex, spending sprees, binge eating or drug abuse, or sabotaging success by suddenly quitting a good job or ending a positive relationship. Suicidal threats or behavior or self-injury, often in response to fear of separation or rejection. Wide mood swings lasting from a few hours to a few days, which can include intense happiness, irritability, shame, or anxiety. Ongoing feelings of emptiness. Inappropriate, intense anger, such as frequently losing your temper, being sarcastic or bitter, or having physical fights. Cortical dysfunction. This refers to a problem in the cortex in the brain that controls motor skills, which we learn at a young age. It's vital for personal, social, and academic success, but having this dysfunction can cause you to have difficulties in all of those areas and is often linked to Alzheimer's disease. Chronic static. From what I could find on static when it comes to psychological testing are mental static and static thoughts. Basically, it's a belief that the world is unchanging. The person believes the way things are now is how they always have been and always will be. Splitting. From counselingresources.com, they say, splitting is a term that came out of classical, psychoanalytical, or psychodynamic schools of thought and refers to an unconscious ego defense mechanism by which a fairly complex entity cannot be accepted into consciousness in its entirety because it contains aspects that are both acceptable to a person as well as unacceptable. Relatively underdeveloped personalities, most especially borderline personalities, have a hard time incorporating into consciousness seemingly contradictory aspects of the same person or thing. So they unconsciously separate or split objects into two categories, seeing the good side of a person or thing as the part they find acceptable, and the bad side of the person or thing as the part they find painful or unacceptable. And it's much more than just seeing both a good and a bad side to everything. They actually split a single entity into two opposing realities, conceptualizing, for example, a mother who has both a gentle and a terrifying side as alternately good mommy or bad mommy. As a result, they will often alternate between over-idealizing and devaluing the same person. Underdeveloped and poorly integrated personalities not only separate difficult to integrate external objects or persons this way, but they also split into aspects of themselves that are hard to integrate into a cohesive whole. So extreme degrees of internal splitting can result in a fragmentation of the self through such mechanisms as dissociation or even multiple personality formation. From learning-mind.com, what this website says about splitting is thinking in complete opposites or absolutes. People are either good or bad, not accepting of others' views, idolizing individuals, then condemning them, raising one's own esteem by belittling others who think differently, constantly changing one's mind over important issues, employing a changeable perspective of others, switching allegiance quickly, multiple partners with no stable relationships, sudden mood swings, changing one's self-image to suit the circumstances. Early abandonment. I discussed this in a previous episode, along with avoidant attachment style, but to put it simply, the causes are abuse, neglect, abandonment, and environmental issues, such as poverty. HappierHuman.com lists 15 signs of abandonment issues in adults. Number 1. Entering into and maintaining unhealthy relationships. An unhealthy relationship is one that features verbal or physical abuse. It can also feature drug and/or alcohol abuse. Maybe it's both. Someone who has abandonment issues will enter into these relationships even though they are aware that the individual they've chosen is not likely to make a good life partner. And even though they know this, they stay in the relationship because their fear of being alone is stronger than their desire to leave. Number 2. Tendency to become attached to people too quickly. This can lead to codependency. They never want to leave certain situations or relationships out of fear of being alone. Number 3. People-pleasing. Number 4. Extreme jealousy. Number 5. Reluctance or lack of desire to fully commit to a relationship. The desire to have a relationship or friendship is there, but some part of them holds back on fully connecting with others. Number 6. Feeling unworthy in life and love. Number 7. Avoiding emotional intimacy. The person may acknowledge that they love you, but they can't get much deeper than that because they are so guarded and often will be the first to run from a relationship thinking they are protecting themselves. Number 8. Insecurity and self-doubt / low self-esteem. Number 9. Paranoia. Number 10. They have issues with trusting others and always are suspicious. Number 11. Being separated from someone for too long is intolerable and makes them feel lonely, anxious, and have negative thought patterns. That can turn into depression, and the person can become irrational. Number 12. Overly controlling. Number 13. Picking people to be in their lives who are not emotionally available because they don't want to connect on an emotional level. Number 14. Self-sabotage. And number 15. Self-blame. Eileen's IQ in junior high was 81, and her IQ had a dramatic split when she was 14 years old. As an adult, she was still emotionally and intellectually that 14-year-old child, or even younger. The psychologist also concluded Eileen had signs of borderline personality disorder as a child. With her memory impairment, if Eileen believed something happened one way, she will stand by that. However, she will likely never tell a story the exact same way if you ask her about it the next month or even the next month. But as she recalls events, the stories will and have always maintained a common theme. When recounting the killings, Eileen never changed her story of self-defense. Now, Miss McMahon was interested to know what Eileen's definition of rape was. Eileen said rape was when someone hurts or does something against your will or has injured you in some way. The other thing Eileen defined as rape was when she would have sex with someone and they refused to pay, basically using her and refusing to pay for her services. Miss McMahon stated that Eileen's perception of the world and people around her comes from her impairment and that everyone is a product of their environment in some way. Every day that has come before us, our psychodynamics, and cognitive ability to cope. When Eileen's cognition gets overwhelmed, for example, when she is emotionally aroused, her ability to make good judgments goes out the window. She sees the world as malevolent. Also, during the penalty phase, her brother, Barry Warnos, took the stand. He testified that their family was straight and narrow, not abusive, but at the same time, Barry left for the service when Eileen was 10 years old, which is when things allegedly began going downhill. Barry didn't have any bad things to say about their grandfather, who, as we know, is their adoptive father. When the penalty phase of the trial came to a close, the jury had a job to do. After taking in everything that took place over the last 2 weeks of the trial, Eileen's fate was in their hands. They deliberated for 2 hours on January 27, 1992, and their decision was that Eileen Warnos was guilty of murder in the first degree and armed robbery. Eileen was extremely distraught when the verdict was announced. She kept looking at the jury constantly in disbelief and shock. When saying her last words to the jury, she stated, quote, "First of all, I'd like to say that I have been labeled a serial killer, and I am no serial killer. I have been framed by law enforcement as a serial killer because of the numerous men involved, but what I was a prostitute. In my prostitution, I deal with a lot of men, at least 200 to 250 a month, and I ran into these men along the way in my prostitution. I was not out there to hurt anyone. I had no intentions of hurting anyone. In my confessions, I stated that 9 times. I stated 37 times it was self-defense, 39 times that they raped, beat, and or had intentions of killing. What I did was what anybody else would do. I defended myself, which everyone has the right to defend themselves. I had no intentions of killing anyone. I would not do that. I'm not that type of person. Anyway, what I'm trying to say here is that in these 2.5 weeks in this courtroom, I told you that I was raped, and that is what happened. That is what happened with all the other cases that I'll be involved in and discussing. These people did violent attacks on me, and I did what I had to do to protect myself. Now, I do have to point out one other thing, and that's the law enforcement has framed me a serial killer, purposely for books and movies. Since I have been incarcerated a year in jail, have gone through a lot of physical and mental abuse, which I feel is being a conspiracy to the law enforcement, and I also believe the law enforcement and the state attorneys have a conspiracy here. I have to say another thing. As far as manipulation was talked about yesterday in the courtroom, I believe by State Attorney Tanner, he was manipulating the jury, which he had made a hell of a lot of things up. They were just made up off the top of his head, were not true, and I feel that he lied right through his teeth. I was up in that stand there, and I did not lie. I was coerced into making my confessions. I was threatened that Tyra Moore would be arrested if I did not talk about the confessions. I was also coerced and threatened that if I did not answer their questions the way they wanted, or any other way, that they would arrest Tyra. The questions they asked me were to strictly implicate me as a serial killer, when every time I talked about a rape, they cut me off. They had my mind all messed up where I was hysterical. I was in trauma, and I was alcohol withdrawing. I have been totally under duress and delirium, and I couldn't tell you what happened anyway. I couldn't remember anything under that stress. All I had in my mind was focused on Tyra, which I was trying to clear her, and Tyra knows it is self-defense, and she is lying through her teeth, telling that she doesn't know anything, even the smallest details of our life together for 4.5 years, and she does know. She knows it's self-defense. She's been offered $500,000, and she might be a multimillionaire by the time this thing is over, and she's just keeping her mouth shut because they have to get a conviction in order to get this money. That's all I got to say. I'm not a serial killer. This episode is sponsored by Athletic Greens. With one delicious scoop of AG1, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. All the things. It's lifestyle friendly. Whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free, there's less than 1 gram of sugar, no GMOs, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything, while still tasting good. You'll get better sleep, better recovery, better mental clarity, and alertness. To make it easy, Athletic Greens is going to give you a free year of supply of immune-supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase at athleticgreens.com/emerging. Again, that is athleticgreens.com/emerging to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. After her defense made a few statements, Eileen chimed in saying she needed to speak again. What I'd like to also say is that we had two clients that were willing to testify for me that we did not bring the mitigating factors into it, and I was surprised that my lawyers had me just testify on this stand and then say the defense rests its case. I did not know this was going to happen. We had a police officer who was going to testify that they misused evidence and that they falsified reports. All of the evidence on the floor, half of the stuff was mine, and there was a radio on the floor that one of the victim's family said, "Yeah, that's mine," and it isn't. It was our radio, and Tyra knows that, and I'm sure I could get a witness to verify that's the radio I had before Richard Mallory was ever killed. I kept the weapons in storage. None of the weapons were on the floor for proof if I ever got busted that I could prove that these guys used these weapons on me. None of these weapons were in evidence, and we had two clients. We had a police officer and some of my high school friends, at least 15, that I wanted contacted, but they were not contacted. To testify for myself, it seemed like I got a total raw deal. The police officer should have went up. I should have had my high school friends testify for me. I couldn't believe I just got in that stand for myself. I was telling the complete truth. I was being as honest as I could be. On March 31st, 1992, Eileen pleaded no contest, which is also seen as guilty. When it came to the murders of Dick Humphreys, Troy Barres, and David Spears. When it came to these three men, she was given three life sentences on May 15, 1992.
I sentence you to death for the murder of David Spears.
Thank you. And probably see, I'll be up in heaven while y'all are rotting in hell.
Okay, there will be an automatic appeal. You have the right to an appeal. Mr. Glazer, is that going to be handled by you
May
or the public defender?
May your wife and kids get raped.
I would ask that you would appoint the public defender's office.
Okay, I'll appoint the public defender's office to handle the appeal. There's one other thing that I want to say that I think needs to be said.
I know I was raped. You weren't nothing but a bunch of scum.
Therefore, these proceedings are now
putting
completed.
Putting somebody who was raped
right,
to death?
Motherfucker!
The next month, she pleaded guilty to the murder of Charles Kaskaden. In November of 1992, she was sentenced to death, which would now be her fifth death sentence. It was around this time that her defense team found out about Richard Mallory's past and tried their best to bring that evidence in during the Charles Kaskaden trial. They had found Richard Mallory intended to commit rape in Maryland. He was tried and committed to a max security prison where he received remediation, as did all sexual offenders. According to Richard Mallory's records that the defense was able to get their hands on, from 1958 to 1962, he was receiving treatment and under observation. And he was to continue this for 8 years. In 1961, it was observed of Mr. Mallory that he possessed strong sociopathic trends. However, the judge would not allow any of this into evidence, and Eileen's request for a retrial was rejected. A few months later, in February of 1993, Eileen pleaded guilty to the murder of Walter Gino Antonio, receiving her sixth death sentence. As far as Peter seems, after Eileen's May 1992 sentence, she offered to show police where his body was hidden in South Carolina. After she was flown there, nothing was found, and Daytona police suspect it was all a ploy for Eileen to get herself a vacation of sorts. Peter Seams's body, police assume, could likely have been discarded in a swamp near I-95. To this day, his body has never been found. She did appeal her sentences a few times, but finally gave up. She accepted that she was going to die. Nick Broomfield was a filmmaker, and during her time in prison, he had numerous interviews with Eileen. In 2001, she petitioned the Florida Supreme Court for the right to fire her attorneys and to put a stop to any and all appeals. She said, quote, "I killed those men, robbed them as cold as ice, and I'd do it again, too. There's no chance in keeping me alive or anything because I'd kill again. I have hate crawling through my system. I'm so sick of hearing this she's crazy stuff. I've been evaluated so many times. I'm competent, sane, and I'm trying to tell the truth. I'm one who seriously hates human life and would kill again." However, in an interview with Nick Broomfield, once she thought the camera was no longer rolling, she whispered to him that every killing was in self-defense, insinuating she just said those other things to hopefully get her way and be executed with no more attorneys and appeals. She was re-evaluated by 3 psychiatrists to make sure she was mentally prepared to be executed, and all 3 said she was lucid and cognizant as to why she was going to be executed.
Lee is one of the most primitive individuals I've ever met. By that I mean that she is probably at the level of about a 3 or 4 year old child emotionally.
There are many people who were abused as children, who were raped. They don't pick up a gun and kill. What's the difference?
My sense is Lee strikes out at everybody. And is angry at everybody, feels betrayed by everybody, cannot figure out how the world operates, that there's a whole set of rules out there that everybody else knows about and Lee doesn't. She wants the situation, as she perceives it to be right now, to be different. And the only way she sees to do that is to request the death penalty. Does she fully understand that this means that she will die and not be here tomorrow? No, Lee doesn't understand that ramification of her statements.
McMahon has dealt with hundreds of killers. She believes that Warnos is a special case, that she should not be put to death.
One of the things in our law is that we do not put to death children. In my clinical opinion, Lee is a child. She's chronologically an adult. She is emotionally, psychologically a child.
On March 23rd, 1993, Eileen was on the Geraldo Show, and this is what she said about not going through with any more appeals.
It's something you have to do in defense.
So are you saying that all 7 of those homicides were justifiable?
In my belief, yes.
I'm curious, if you believe that, why in the last several weeks have you been telling the courts that you don't want to participate in your own defense, that you want the death penalty?
I'm not going to allow them to put me in life in prison when I've been viciously raped, viciously tormented. I've suffered a great deal. I've been raped numerous times, even before I got the gun. Why should I allow you to say, oh, we're sorry, we'll overturn the sentence and give you life, that you're just putting me through torment again when I did something to keep myself alive? I'd rather die.
You'd rather die in the electric chair?
I would rather die in electric chair or natural death than to live life in prison and be tormented continually the rest of my life when I don't deserve it. It's either acquittal or death, because what I did, anybody would have done.
But when you give the state a kind of defiant declaration, acquittal or death, don't you know what side the cards are likely to fall on?
Yeah, corruption, death. I'm not afraid of dying. I love the Lord, and matter of fact, I want to die now. I've been through so much hell in this world and so much the people refuse to listen. The public refuses to care because of prostitution.
Why don't you say, I'm sorry. I'm sorry I killed those men.
I am sorry I killed those men now. Now that I'm into religion, I mean, I'm sorry it happened. I wish it never would have happened. But same token, you all got to look at the facts that I killed in self-defense and quit listening to these lying cops.
But do you understand why they say that you don't show any remorse?
Because why should I? The cops made me so mad at all the lying and everything, I can't show any remorse.
But deep down, here, I'm not a cop. I want you to say you're sorry. Say you're sorry to the innocent families.
The innocent families. Those families aren't innocent.
What?
Those men aren't innocent. I'm not giving in. Those men are not innocent.
Why don't you want to live for Ty, if you love her so?
Tyra has her own life now to lead on. And, I don't think, I mean, I would love to be back with Ty and everything, but I don't believe she'd ever come back to me. I don't know. I don't want to live. Why are you lingering me on death row? You stay this execution. Should be the next day then. Good. Let me go.
After 10 years on death row, she was allowed to let her attorneys go and drop all appeals. Right before Eileen's execution date in 2002, there were two attempts to stop the execution from happening. A private attorney from Tampa wrote a letter to the Florida Supreme Court saying he had serious concerns about Eileen's competency. The other attempt came from an Ohio group who wanted to file an appeal on Eileen's behalf. Both of those proposals were rejected. Billy Nolis, one of Eileen's representatives in the Richard Mallory trial, stated, quote, "Eileen Wuornos is the most disturbed individual I have ever represented. Her fate was sealed. Even though in November of 1992, Dateline NBC even reported about Richard Mallory's rape charges, but due to poor investigation and insufficient defense researching, this fact didn't matter during Eileen's earlier trials and would never matter. The prosecution made Richard Mallory out to be a man with no history of sexual violence. Mistakes like these are one of the reasons many people end up on death row." Also, I found that in 2002, Eileen wrote a 25-page complaint letter to Judge Paul Backman. To the Honorable Paul Backman, in reference to prison harassment with abuse of authority, requesting as well that these pages and documentation presented before you today, July 12, 2002, be sent likewise to the Honorable Thomas D. Hall for the Florida Supreme Court. Recorded before you here in documentation gives you a light of insight to the various areas I've been having the problems in, giving you then a broader input to what I've been up against. Thank you for your time and reading. Eileen listed 4 sergeants and 5 officers, all females, that she said had been causing problems with her on death row. These particular sergeants and officers listed above have used a number of things against me here on death row that could amount to cruel and unusual behavior with such in psychological and physical warfare whenever they're scheduled to the floor. And may I add, they are intentionally scheduled. And to list some of the various problems coming from these particular staff workers, I can tell you that, 1, they're improperly cuffing us whenever we step out of our cells, squeezing them on too tight and bruising the wrists. 2, improper strip searches whenever there's a visit by being disrespectful and acting as if a baton is being put up ya. 3, catcalling on the unit, things in distaste and pure hatred towards me that are catcalled from the office or on the way out of it whenever leaving the unit, And with all of these acoustics around, it's easily to be heard. Number 4. Dozens of fingers being flung up at the window whenever they window check. Number 5. Excessive window checking. For years, it's always been on the hour, but now they're doing it every 5, 10, 20 minutes ordered by the colonel, and it's absolutely, quote, nonsensical and harassive. Number 6. Repeatedly kicking at my door whenever a window check's made. And to remind you, sir, only the 4 sergeants and officers listed on page 1 are doing this. All others in personnel have been okay. Number 7. Inedible food trays are handed to me only when these particular sergeants and officers are on. Number 8. There are gatherings in the office engaged in conversations that are in discussions to mistreat the inmate with all of anything. Number 9. I'm overhearing conversations of them wishing they could move me from this cell closer to the office, as that by their terms I overheard they could harass me to death with all their buddied up traffic coming and going out of their unit, be that at least every 15 minutes. And then, sir, I need to advise you a bit more here, that this cell is in accordance with the FAC, and as long as I am, then I'm by law not to be moved. While on the other hand, I've been in this cell 7 years, so why would anyone want to anyway? Except to do as I stressed in number 9 here and having overheard, just so I'm close to the office so they could harass me to death. Number 10. I'm hearing conversations and hoping I wind up crying by all the abusive force, as they put it, 24/7. Number 11. I'm overhearing conversations and trying to get me so pushed over the brink by them that I'd wind up committing suicide before the execution. And I guess they're way out of luck with that, since I'm on an active warrant. And needn't to anyways. While on the other hand, if I may, sir, I'd appreciate the laws followed by the Florida Supreme Court in executing, quote, be that of things to be done, civilized. Number 12. Overheard conversations as to how the administration's plans to, as they put it, put everything back as it used to be on the floor without restraints once Warnos is executed. Number 13. An overheard conversation from the office in reference to me and to upset her through cell checks. So now they are posting orders in the office to check our cell whenever we shower. What I also need to tell you, sir, is that I heard the men on death row won a lawsuit on shakedowns, and that they're now only to be conducted, I think, by court order once a year, because obviously they were using such falsifications of security solely to shake up the nerves in this senseless security. Number 14. Also overheard conversations to, as they put it, quote, rub her in the dirt. And so I take it this is why they've been working on the floor more than usual. These 4 sergeants and officers. So they can, quote, rub me in the dirt, because the administration's been advised through a grievance which I haven't received back yet, that I've boycotted all showers and trays whenever any of these sergeants or officers wind up on the floor until it is resolved, as they need to be banned from the unit or any other type of contact with me until my execution. In the meantime, my stomach's growling away, and I'm taking showers through the cell of my sink. Number 15. Then I overheard another one with the prison inspector on the floor in the office be that of Mr. Denmark discussing with some of the sergeants and officers listed on page 1 who've been working overtime, etc. on the unit. That the administration wants the staff to, quote, break her down so we can try to get Warnos medicated. So you're to make her as miserable as possible and bring her way down. We've got to, quote, break her spirit. And I tell ya, I couldn't believe my ears since I'm one of the quietest gals on the floor. I stick to myself and bother no one. And I get along with the staff just fine, except for these four sergeants and officers who obviously have been briefed to hound me to death. So now we clash. While on the other hand, I also clearly heard sometime back around 2002 of February, and that is, sir, I've never been into drugs, just a hair as a teen way back in the Woodstock days, but then gave up that scene, because I grew to hate the experience. So, I quit as a teen around 11 years old, and from 16 up to my arrest of 34, I just stuck to beer. While on the other hand, I haven't any history of being so mentally disturbed that I've had to be medicated. And as I said, since my teens, I've always been against that stuff. Man, I won't even so much as take an aspirin. Yet Sudafed, Advil, and Tylenol are readily available in the office, but never requested in my 11 years here, like others do, daily at times. Like Virginia and Anna, but no thanks with me, just don't believe in it. So everybody's way out of luck with this one too. And I must say, if the prison's that cowardice of me because a number were killed, then they need to take the med themselves. Because personally, I don't believe in the stuff and would never stoop for anyone and take it. Also to say here that to push me through psychological and physical warfare so they would just because they feel I should sounds 100% illegal to me. And why now be so persistent hoping to achieve over this model prisoner months away from an execution when in all my 11 years I've never touched the stuff here, not even aspirin. So if they're that scared of me, man, then take the stuff themselves. As far as them achieving their goal, again, way out of luck, because I could easily hold a full brim of water for a good while without a spill. And if anyone would like to see this done, be my guest in the testimonial box. Number 16. There's two women left on the floor. Be those of Virginia and Anna. Now these two women are being shown an enormous amount of respect with favoritism by the very list of sergeants and officers on page 1. And because I've sent grievances out on these four sergeants and officers, of which many have never returned to me, are receiving a huge amount of static now from these two left here on death row. They refuse to speak to me and hate my guts now because, as they put it, I'm picking on their favorites that work the floor. All of which, these harassing me, are loving it up because now if they abuse me, they're covered by those two. So now I'm really in jeopardy. 17. Lastly, one last note that needs to be addressed that's left me in suspicion of is that right after the Florida Supreme Court decision April 1st to allow me to waive off and fire my lawyers and drop all appeals, moving on then to an execution, arrived next here at this prison was the DOC Secretary Mr. Michael Moore, April 10th and 11th. Then, after his visit, all hell broke loose and an increase to the problems I've been having. As if a hit was put on me, to kill her even before a warrant's to be signed. Finally, I'd like to say that although everything has increased to a serious matter here, there is a simple solution. And that would be to ban these sergeants and officers from the floor or any contact with me until my execution is complete. While on the other hand, I'd like to send a list of sergeants and officers that pulled off once I waved, who for years worked the floor and know every bit of Supreme Court laws and how the floors are to be worked. Surely then all will be revealed, as long as they quit calling for abuse. Thank you for your time. Respectfully yours, Eileen C. Warnos, Death Row. In another letter, she said, listed are sergeants and officers who've worked on death row for years and who know every bit of the Supreme Court laws as to how the floors should be run. Once I waved off appeals, they were then instantly pulled off, only to be replaced with aggressive staff, as well as inexperienced new personnel who know nothing about the floor. Being merely handed the keys and act with us as they so please, especially with me. So it's a mess. While an easy rectification would be simply to reinstate the staff listed, senselessly pulled off on the floor back on it. Then, on the other hand, if memory serves me correct, this is a Florida Supreme Court and a United States Supreme Court law that staff who run the Supreme Court laws are to be the only ones to work the floor. The inmates are to be treated fair and square in housing. So listed are the names who used to work the floor for years. As far as sergeants and officers, gathering in the office talking to one another about inmates on the floor and their cases, airing extreme hatred then in those conversations over us, discussing between one another how they could be, quote, mistreated and write us up for just the least of anything, which then is psychological warfare that could most assuredly cause a conflict and an interest to security and any work relationship between us. By law, this unit is to be a relaxed one so that we can concentrate on cases and all of any work we used to do, not messing with our heads so that we can't. Quote, that's not what we're housed here for. And by law, staff are to use a sense of sensitivity with us, not being aggressive and combative. They are monitoring our likes and dislikes through general conversations, then basically using dislikes against us for abuse. Again, psychological warfare that's flat against all statutes and constitutions on death row. Turning the water pressure down, which then messes with the sink and toilet for proper flushing and the running of it. And I know it is coming from our upstairs since a staff worker went ahead and shouted it out to us from out in the parking lot, having said then, quote, hey, death row, the water pressure is being played with from upstairs. That is a violation to sanitational procedures. Turning the air conditioner off for death row, which then the rooms start mildewing, so much so that my mattress is turning moldy. It is slowly turning it black underneath. They are complaining about our necessities and our daily needs. For instance, saying we use too much toilet tissue, which is just another violation about sanitation. It's the law that no matter how much is used, they must provide for the inmate at all times. And to be quite honest, I don't think we excessively use anything. We're just sane enough to keep ourselves clean is all, while on the other hand, they're looking for anything to hate us, it seems. The shower window. It used to be taped over for privacy, all of which, by law, were to have as much privacy rights as the general population. Therefore, a curtain or something should be placed over our shower windows so that we're allowed to shower privately just as general population does. Handcuffs, and using two staff workers to escort us from out of our cell to walk across the floor to the shower from out of our rooms. Death row is only segregated because of executions, and since we are by law to be treated as general population in our privileges and privacy, then what's up with the cuffs? We've never posed a security threat, so there's no grounds for this. Again, the law is being broken and allowing us to be housed as general population. Restraining with cuffs just to step out to take a shower is utterly ridiculous. It's complete nonsense. Excessive checking at the window, again, nonsensical and just plain harassive. None of us have ever been an escape risk, a threat, or suicidal, so there's no reason for this either. By law, it's once an hour, and to be quite frank, it should be once every 2 hours, since it's supposed to be a relaxed dorm, and none of these confinement issues should be obtaining to us. Should ever there be a problem, physical or otherwise, we're able-bodied and sane enough to address it to someone, or say for an emergency to get a staff worker on. Excessive cell checkups. The men on death row won a lawsuit with shakedowns, and by court order are now to be only done once a year. While on the other hand, why even bother when we go nowhere, have access to nothing except canteens, and again have never aired problems in all of these years to need any reason to suddenly freak out and start checking our cells every day. I can only see this as pure harassment for intentional discomfort, all of which is definitely against the law. By the Florida Supreme Court, there is to be no intentional harassment, discomfort, or again, any psychological or physical warfare. Food trays. Dinner trays are to arrive by policy at 4 p.m. along with the mail, and all passed out together. We are receiving them as late as 6 o'clock, 6:30. They are also coming to us unedible. Either the meat's not fully cooked, or the meat and vegetables are not. Along with one other problem. If I ask for a sub, a regular tray comes instead, or vice versa. So that once the trays arrive like this, and the orders remade, I've waited 3 hours. Everyone has now had lunch but me. They're using any info of any kind as a measure to turn around and use it for abuse against the inmate, especially on verbal complaints. Not resolving, but only increasing the problem. They're being verbally disrespectful or using a form of charades to air the disrespect towards the inmate. Example, giving the finger or without saying it out loud, but instead just charading it with their lips, like read my lips kind of deal, are voicing to the inmates to go to hell or to kill themselves, etc. There needs to be stability established with staff workers towards inmates. Personalizing cases to use as an excuse to hate the inmate is against the law. If they have a hate problem with a death row inmate, then they shouldn't be on the floor, but banned from working the unit, even with overtime. Calling the staff and being threatened with a doctor or not being answered if I call and call, just ignoring us all the while trying to get their attention. There's a statute which states that not only are they in this unit for security, but for our needs and necessities as well, and that they are to respond to any call that any inmate makes in case it should be for an emergency above all else. Grievances destroyed. I've sent grievances out on many occasions, but they never came back. So obviously to cover up the problems and continue to use cruelty, destroyed documentation, or so that they could keep on doing what they're doing illegally and increase the pressure. By law, destroying any institutional documentation or falsifying anything, that person is to be immediately terminated. There is no alternative from what I've read. Yet someone or a group of people could care less as to what the law means or so much as to what it says. That's for sure. hanging around Virginia's door. Sergeant Carter, especially, will hang around it for hours. My problem with it is that the conversation then tends to lead to other inmates' likes and dislikes, all of which is none of anybody's business and is illegal prying into. When personnel are on the floor, they're not to be talking about inmates with other ones. This is one of the personnel ethic codes, and so this is a violation in privacy, and it could cause conflicts in security with personalizing them. Toilet flushing. They're checking windows whenever a toilet is flushed. What for? No one on death row is a smoker. I myself quit back in November of 96, so there was not a pack of smokes or lighter in any cell and never will be. And since I'm on the subject of the toilet and again remind you, upstairs has been playing with our water pressure, so much so that the toilet won't even flush. Toilet paper comes right back up whenever they mess with it. Excessive pulling on the handle. Every 5 minutes when Sergeant Carter makes her nonsense checks, they'll pull violently on the door handle to make sure it's locked. When this unnecessary habit of hers is now causing lights on the panel of the office to stay on, and so you can see just another problem that needn't occur. In all my years here, if ever the door accidentally opened, I would always tell them it was so they could come and make sure it would get locked back up, plain and simple. Catcalling. I've heard them do it in the office, out of it, and on the way out, and even in the parking lot against death row. Disrespect and pure hatred. She also wrote, "Sir, since the transport orders came in to appear in court, my food has been played with royal, from being uncooked, to spit on, to tasting tainted with something, to rotted food or vegetables, going so far as to even cooking potatoes in dirt, then put on the tray. And if you'd like a polygraph, there's no problem. I'll take a polygraph to anything that's being presented before you today. Yet I came up with a solution that may solve this insanity. Be it that once the trays are filled, to have a staff worker sign off to it. Either they fill it up, then sign off to it on a piece of paper that would come with the tray, or watch an inmate fill it out, then sign off, putting it under the cellophane that's wrapped over it." In some of her grievance letters, she talks about being in earshot, overhearing these sergeants and officers wishing to rape her before the execution, to attack and transport to the execution itself. I will post a link to these 25 pages. There is so much more to this, but a lot of it is repetitive. Eileen did say that things got a bit better after Mr. Single stepped in, who is a lawyer, and her complaints were made. The day before her execution, Eileen had one last interview with filmmaker Nick Broomfield. I'm going to play for you her final sit-down with Nick.
You know, I was just wondering how you're going to be, you know, at 9:30 tomorrow morning. Are you prepared?
I'm prepared. I'm all right. I'm all right with it.
How?
I'm all right with it, but like I said, remember, let them know that I know that the cops knew who I was after Richard Mallory died. I left prints everywhere, and they covered it up and let me kill the rest of those guys to turn me into a serial killer. I know they did, because I was no professional serial killer or anything, or murderer, or whatever you want to call it, you know. I wasn't special at what I was doing.
Eileen, how...
I did some sloppy work, you know, and I left...
How have you prepared yourself for tomorrow morning?
I'm all right with it. Yeah, I'm ready to go. Hey, I was tortured at BCI. They had the intercom on in the room, and they kept lying that it wasn't on, and they were using sonic pressure on my head since 1997.
Sonic
and
pressure.
Every time I was trying to write something, I think they had some kind of eye in the cell, I'm not sure, but every time I started writing something, it went up higher. So I'm thinking that probably had the TV rigged. The TV or the mirror, something was rigged. They got a huge satellite on the compound. After they put the huge satellite on the compound, it could have been either rigged to the TV set or the mirror or something, because the electrician, when he put the mirror on the wall, he said, doesn't that look like a computer? The back of it, and he stuck it to the wall.
And do you think, what, did that affect your mind, do you think?
Huh?
Did that affect your mind in some way, the sonic?
It was crushing my head, and they were using sonic pressure continually. Then when I had 3 meetings with Miss Villacorta on it, every meeting I had, she increased the pressure of the volume of the comm, increased the harassment on the floor, increased the trays being inedible, just increased every bit of my complaints and trashed all grievances. They're trying to make it look like I was crazy at all times, rig up the room with torture. If I said anything about their whole plan was to try to make it look like I was totally crazy, and so nobody would believe anything I had to say about anything, and then drive me there if they could. I suffered so bad. I was really struggling to survive. Had a lot of trays that were attempted murder and everything. I had to wash all my food off. Then one day I didn't wash my food off, and I was sick for 3 weeks, almost died.
But you're okay now.
I'm okay. I'm okay. God is going to be there. Jesus Christ is going to be there. All the angels and everything. And, you know, whatever's on the beyond, I think it's going to be more like Star Trek, beaming me up into a space vehicle, man. Then I move on, recolonize to another planet or whatever. But it's whatever's the beyond, I know it's going to be good, because I didn't do anything as wrong as they said. I did the right thing. And I saved a lot of people's butts from getting hurt and raped and killed, too.
So are you saying that you killed in self-defense or in cold blood? Because you've changed your story. I'm just trying to
understand. What are you talking about? Changed story on what?
No, about whether it was self-defense or not.
I'm not going to say it. You know, I'm not going to get in depth about my cases, Nick. I'm on my way to the chamber. Nothing's stopping it. You can believe it or you don't have to believe it. That's up to you, man. Put a big question mark on your film.
What more is there to say about the cops? What more do you want to say about the cops?
A lot of stuff. Did you know that they were surveilling me before I killed? And then I knew it? And that it was covered up? Did you know there was helicopters dropping down from the sky, deputy sheriff, with decoys picking me up 4 or 5 months before my arrest? It was covered up?
But nonetheless,
nobody ever asked me these questions.
Whether the cops were following you or not, Eileen?
Oh, whether the cops were following me or not, Eileen,
okay,
what?
Let's say the cops were following you.
Yeah.
Let's say they were following you and they did everything that you're saying they did.
Uh-huh.
Nonetheless, you killed 7 men.
Yes, you did.
And I'm asking you, what got you to kill the 7 men?
And I'm telling you, because the cops let me keep killing them, Nick. Don't you get it?
Not everybody is killing 7 people. So there must have been something in you that was getting you to do that.
Oh, you are lost, Nick.
So
I was a hitchhiking hooker.
Right.
Running into trouble. I shoot the guy if I ran into trouble. Physical trouble. The cops knew it. When the physical trouble came along, let her clean the streets. And then we'll pull her in.
But
that's
how come
why.
There was so much physical trouble? Because it was all in 1 year. 7 people in 1 year.
Oh, well. Oh, well.
But why not say now?
Because I'm out of retaliation for taking my life like this and getting rich off it all these years in total pathological lying. Yeah, thanks a lot. I lost my fucking life because of it. Couldn't even get a fair trial. Couldn't even get a fair investigation or nothing. Couldn't even have my appeals right. You sabotaged my ass, society, and the cops and the system. A raped woman got executed. It was used for books and movies and shit. Ladder climbs, re-election, everything else. I got a big finger in all your faces. Thanks a lot. You're an inhumane bunch of fucking living bastards and bitches. And you're going to get your asses nuked in the end. And pretty soon it's coming. 2019, Iraq's supposed to hit you anyhow. You're all going to get nuked. You don't take fucking human life like this and just sabotage and rip it apart like Jesus on the cross and say thanks a lot for all the fucking money I made off of you. And not care about a human being and the truth being told. Now I know what Jesus was going through. They've been trying to tell the truth, and I keep getting it stepped on. Concerned about if I was raped, I'm not giving you book and movie info. I'm giving you info for investigations and stuff, and that's it. We're going to have to cut this interview, Nick. I'm not going to go into any more detail. I'm leaving. I'm glad. Thanks a lot, Society, for railroading my ass. Okay, let's go.
October 9th, 2002, execution day. Eileen chose not to have a final meal and instead drank a little coffee. At 9:47 that morning, Eileen was declared deceased, being the second woman in Florida and 10th in the nation to be put to death since capital punishment was restored in a 1976 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. Her final words before her execution were, quote, "Yes, I'd just like to say I'm sailing with the rock and I'll be back, like Independence Day, with Jesus. June 6th, like the movie. Big mothership and all. I'll be back. I'll be back." So this wraps up the Eileen Wuornos series. Thank you so much for listening. And until next time, everyone stay safe and take care.